Hello and welcome to the Aparo Effect, a podcast put together to talk with nonprofits and with donors to learn more about what's going on in our community and best practices to lift the service sector across our community. I am here today with Aaron Randolph, who is the CEO of Carolina Youth Coalition, and he'll give us a little more information about himself, his background, how he got there, and that kind of thing. And we are here to talk about the Aparo Carolina Youth Coalition partnership, as well as more importantly, even about Carolina Youth Coalition's journey as a smaller nonprofit to a, they're not that they're huge, but to a larger than small nonprofit, and some of the learnings that Aaron has had along the way that we thought might be valuable to the nonprofits listening, as well as any small, medium businesses who are listening who might take away some of the learnings that he's had on the journey. So, Aaron, I'm going to turn to you to give any more information about, let's say, give a little more information about how you got to your job, what inspires you in your job, and your journey as a professional, how you got to where you are.
Absolutely. Well, first, thank you, Kim, for having me. And I'm obviously a big fan of Aparo, so happy to share our story and the impact that you all have had on our journey so far. So I'm executive director and co-founder of Carolina Youth Coalition. Carolina Youth Coalition, or CYC, is a education nonprofit here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And our mission is to nurture and propel high-achieving, under-resourced students to and through college. And so essentially what that means is we partner with community organizations and schools to identify young people in our community who've shown academic potential and desire to go to college, but maybe because they are the first in their family to go to college or come from a low-income family, face significant barriers to both college access and college graduation. And so through our programs, we provide a continuum of programs and resources that start in ninth grade and extend all the way through college graduation. We were founded here in Charlotte in 2018 with just 40 high school students and have since then seen an enormous amount of growth. Last year, we served over 200 high school students, high school program. And then we have also acquired or continued to work with about 150 college students as well. So just a lot of
Wow.
growth in even through the pandemic, we almost doubled in terms of the numbers of students we were serving. So
That's
our
more
story
than doubled, Aaron.
is
That's like four times. That's
absolutely.
massive.
And so with that definitely comes a lot of learnings, right? And things that we've had to adapt with along the way. Our story actually starts though before 2018. We're patterned after an organization in Louisiana called the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition that I previously worked for before relocating to Charlotte in 2017. And thanks to the support of a mutual funder, the Albemarle Foundation, when I relocated to Charlotte, had an opportunity to get some seed funding because they were interested in bringing a version of that program to Charlotte because they had seen how well it worked in Louisiana. And so they were really the catalyst for our founding, and we've taken that support and brought others into the fold and continued to grow from there.
Wow. Was Carolina Youth Coalition, except the one in Louisiana, was that your first job?
That's well, first time leading an organization, yes, first time being executive director. Prior to working at CYC and then at the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition, I actually started my career as a teacher. So I did a year with AmeriCorps through a program
Yeah.
called City Year right after undergraduate that originally took me to Louisiana. I had a really transformative experience within that program, and that really cemented, I think, my passion and desire to build a career out of working in education specifically. I went to grad school and then decided to come back to go back to Louisiana to start my teaching career. So I taught middle school, high school, and social middle school and high school social studies before working at the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition on that organization. So I still consider myself an educator at heart. That's what I'm trained to do. But definitely over these last 5 years, have learned to be a nonprofit executive as I've taken on this role.
It's a journey. It's a journey.
Absolutely.
So tell me when you came, well, when you start to use the term 2018 here in Charlotte, how many staff were there then in 2018? Was it just
So
one?
So I got, and this is actually a pretty critical part of, I think, building our organization. So in the second half of 2017, the Albemarle Foundation and Catherine Cassan, who's now our board chair, basically funded me to do a 4 months needs assessment. And so being new to Charlotte, I had a chance to literally just meet with dozens of teachers, educators, nonprofit leaders, school principals, district officials, and really just get a lay of the land. And we were trying to assess three things. Was there a need for an organization like Carolina Youth Coalition in Charlotte? The first thing we heard when we got to Charlotte is there's too many nonprofits. So we didn't want to add to that number if there wasn't an actual need. And we got a great response that there definitely was. Two, how do we fit into the landscape of the work that's already happening, particularly within education, within college and career readiness, within youth development? And actually, out of a lot of those conversations, that was kind of the start of a lot of the partnerships we still have today with other organizations. And then three, the financial feasibility. So we were fortunate on the back end of that to get the announcement from Albemarle that they were going to give us a 5-year seed funding commitment to help us.
Oh, get isn't started. That wonderful?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's how we got started. And then 2018 was kind of the official, we incorporated in North Carolina and I was hired. So I worked for myself, well, by myself, probably about 9 months. And then we hired our first employee in June of 2018. In that first year, we had three employees for the organization.
And how many do you have now?
This year we have 13 full-time and 2 part-time. So 15.
So let me kind of summarize what Aaron's just been talking about here. He's talked about starting with serving 40, now serving 200 plus 150 who are in the college spectrum because he was bringing people through that journey to the success at the end of college. So technically serving 350 when originally serving 40.
This year we'll have about 400 total.
There you go, from 40. So 10 times growth in 4 years. Yeah. Staff growth of 1 to, what did you say?
Roughly 15.
15, yeah. 15 individuals. Okay. Small organization starts, grows. Impact's growing. Staff is growing. What were some of the hurdles that you saw early on that you knew, I've got to get this in place if I'm going to, did you see the growth coming? I mean, did you see it? Did you know it was going to be that kind? Or did you think, well, we'll just see what happens and see how the numbers fall?
I felt like we could be really successful in terms of the outcomes we were driving with whatever number of students we were going to be able to work with. I don't know if I foresaw, particularly when the pandemic hit, that we would continue to grow and even increase our growth through that time period. For me, it took a lot of self-awareness, I think. So I'll give myself some credit on this. So really, when I started and accepted the job as executive director, I knew that there were a lot of gaps in my own knowledge about running an organization. So I spent most of my time previously in programming and operations, and I felt very strongly about that. However, now that I'm running an organization, obviously fundraising and development is a significant part of my job. Now I'm managing other people. So we have to put in like an employee handbook and have HR policies and practices. I had to learn a lot about just financial stewardship and good practices relative to our accounting and reporting in that regard. And so I think what was really important for me early, one was to recognize those shortcomings and not be stubborn about it, but to also advocate within my board that we needed to add some outside resources to help fill those gaps and make sure that we were building a foundation and a structure that could facilitate the growth that we anticipated having. So early on, what that looked like is the first year of CYC, actually, we were still waiting for our 501c3 designation from the IRS. And so
I remember this.
We were under fiscal sponsorship of Children and Family Services Center. which actually turned out to be a huge blessing because it allowed us to hire employees under like a leased employee agreement with them. So all of our employees were able to get benefits and a full PTO package and everything through Children and Family Services Center, which is key for attracting talent. And then two, they had a very formalized structure for both HR and accounting. And so having to work within that structure was a crash course for me and sort of best practices that we were able to implement once we were not under fiscal sponsorship anymore. So that was a great experience. And I would really credit them with the job they do with helping organizations move from fiscal sponsorship to being under their own 501c3.
Isn't that fantastic? And they've rebranded now. They are Ascend.
Ascend Nonprofit Solutions. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fantastic. So I'm going to bring you to Aparo to talk a little bit about, because as I'm looking at, we have these things, you won't see it, podcast listener, but I'm looking at what we call a roadmap, a journey map that just looks at all the different ways that Carolina Youth Coalition and Aparo have connected. And it looks like we started talking through a program we call Tech Therapy, which is tech advice and counsel, and it's no cost. It's just a partner along the way in a space that one might not have skills of one's of themselves. In 2019, so very early on in your process, what brought you to those conversations and why, what were you hoping to get? What were you seeing that you were lacking or that you needed to do more of?
Mm-hmm. I think there were two things. One being we had some immediate tech needs that I was trying to solve for. The first being at this point, we got started with several large foundation and corporate grants. Throughout that first year, we started to get more and more individual donations. So through our annual campaign and events we were having, and we were still tracking donors and donations on a spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. And it was an absolute pain to like keep up with. And I just felt like we were dropping the ball somewhere, had to be. And it was very time intensive on my part. So the first was to kind of shore up that need by identifying a CRM that we could use mm-hmm. to automate some of those processes and better track our donor management and be better at our stewardship. The second was I knew we had some long-term technology needs, and I knew being proactive about implementing both from a hardware and software standpoint would allow us to not end up in a tech crisis 2 or 3 years down the road. We could plan for our growth and put things in place so that we would have them when we got to those stages where we needed them. And so the other part of the project that we ended up doing with Aparo the first time was a tech roadmap, both from a hardware and software standpoint, to kind of map out where do we anticipate growing as an organization. And then what are the hardware and software needs that we need to be looking at acquiring along the way so that we can just be in a good place and operate efficiently through the use of technology?
So it sounds to me like you have some knowledge of technology or its capabilities.
I'd say I'm pretty tech savvy.
So talk a little bit about as this burgeoning, growing, metamorphosizing, whatever the word may be, nonprofit. How would somebody who maybe doesn't have that technology, so you decided these things were important. Why would they, you knew they were important, but somebody who doesn't know they're important, why do you think it was important in the early stages to think about some of that, what I would call infrastructure, capacity for your organization? Why does that matter? In your early stages?
So like in football, they use a term called the 12th man, and it's like the crowd, right? That's the 12th man on the field for the home team, just because of the effect they can have on the game and on the opposing players. So I think about technology as like however many number of employees you have, there's like a plus one, which is your technology. And it can really save you time and allow you to focus your effort and capacity on your mission work if you have technology that allows you to do that. And so what that looks like on a day-to-day basis, that may be, you know, the 30 minutes to an hour you have to spend manually tracking something on a spreadsheet or sorting through emails or whatever unautomated processes you have now. That time adds up. And as nonprofits, we have very little capacity to begin with. And so you don't want to be bogged down in some of those more administrative tasks and things that technology could solve, rather than being focused on your mission work and the people you're trying to serve and the communities you're trying to help. And so for me, it was more about how do we kind of operate like an organization that's bigger than we are, right? How do we fully maximize our capacity? And so one example of this is the CRM allowed us to, through some different workflows, completely automate our student application process. Whereas before, you know, we probably have maybe five different sort of checkpoints throughout that process. Each of those would have had to be done manually. And we were at a point where just the number of applications we were getting was possible for someone to do it manually. It would take a lot of time. But what I knew is, looking ahead, we would get to a point where it would not be possible for someone to do the amount of manual work needed to stay on top of that process. And frankly, that's just not the best use of our staff's time. So it was really about saving time and adding capacity is how I looked at it.
That makes sense. How did your funders view that? Did they view that in a positive way? Did they not really care? Did they know you were doing those things?
We were very fortunate early on to get some unrestricted gifts. And so I don't think our funders knew exactly that we were building that capacity, but I'm thankful that their gifts gave us the flexibility to build that capacity.
Absolutely. Yeah. So part of what we see at Paro is we're working out there with partners, and Paro partners with, well, over 700 nonprofits in the greater Charlotte market, as well as a couple of dozens in a couple other markets, is that we find that a lot of the technology engagement that we have is around change management. So it's around, yeah, you're picking an application because you've got to get, you know, you've got to get off paper. You've got to reduce your administrative load so that you can do more mission specific tasks and still have the administrative work done. But there's a lot of unexpected change management that has to happen within the team. Okay, we're going to use this tool, and now you got to do these seven things, and they're going to save you time, but you got to do it. So yeah. What was your change management journey like as you took these different steps to more automate your processes?
I would say it's still a journey. So just thinking about our CRM, for example, I would say not all of our staff is fully comfortable yet with utilizing the CRM. So internally, kind of what that's looked like is, you know, we got everybody trained on it, but we have some sort of experts that have been additionally, they kind of have the master's degree in the CRM. Mm-hmm. And, know how to troubleshoot internally, and then can train other staff if there are particular things that they're having issues with. I will say that I think the other piece too is the technology is always evolving, right? So in the case of our CRM, they've done at least three or four major updates since we've gotten it, which are great. It makes the system better, but that's also time that your staff then has to take to learn those updates, to learn how they can leverage those new functions to be even more efficient and automate what they're doing. So it's a continuous journey.
I would agree with that. And I would say you're doing something that we would refer to as a best practice on any size organization, because we nonprofits, Aparo is a nonprofit as well. We don't have the capacity always to have a technology person on staff. If we get bigger, and we do, aren't we fortunate? Wonderful. But then that's also hard to maintain, because it's a singular function. It's usually a singular person. That can get old. It can get weary to be the only person who's designated that. So what we have recommended to people, and I'm really glad to hear that you're doing this, even with us not recommending, is what we call super users. So on the team, there's usually somebody who kind of resonates with the new system really well, and you kind of maybe give them a bump, or you give them a role that has that designation that they are whatever else they are, director of development, manager of events, whatever it is, but they are the super user for X.
Absolutely.
And then they, you know, there's professional development to be had there. So they keep on top of it. There's always someone internally who can support people who are struggling a little bit more with the tool. So it's good to, good to hear you doing that.
I will say too on that piece, I think that's often a hurdle and something that we've dealt with, right? If technology can be scary for some folks, and not everybody's as excited about utilizing and implementing new technologies. So I think getting staff buy-in and comfort is probably the biggest hurdle, because it doesn't matter how good the system is or how effective it is. If you can't get people to envision, how is this going to make my job easier or save me time or be useful in the way that I need it to be as an individual team member? And so we spent a lot of time on that early on, which wasn't hard because we only have a few employees. So I think people very quickly saw how it could help. But I could see that being, you know, a significant hurdle with a larger organization as well.
Yeah, I think so. I love how you're saying that. So one of the things I'm thinking about is on your journey, and as you're training these people, you know, how that's all that change management, right? So when you go back to the one project that you're talking about that we did together, and we've done three over the last 4 years of being a partner with Carolina Youth Coalition. But that first one around that system for CRM, there's, I'm sure what we did, and you said there were fewer employees, but we did this use case analysis, right? So, and I think you just brought it up. What's important if you're going to do these changes in your organization that will, you know, be infrastructure change, is to get everybody involved, to get them to have that moment to say, I think this is the problem. This is what's driving me crazy. Mm-hmm. And when Aparo does projects, we bring skilled volunteers in to do it. So they're experts in these areas, and they've done this a million times with a million companies, small, big, large. And so, you know, they know how to hear somebody over on the right-hand side of the table saying, oh, this one's driving me crazy. And then somebody else saying, no, that's not, it's this person. They bring it all together. When you have an expert in the room who can say, okay, here are the 20 things you brought out that are painful. Let's talk about how some of them might be the same or how they might connect. And then out of that, what do you need? You got these pains. What would take the pains away? What processes? So I think the partnership of the skilled volunteers is very unique for us, but I think it's also really beneficial. Did you create community from your skilled volunteers? Have you kept any of the skilled volunteers that you've worked with Aparo in your work?
That not from that first group. We did have, so a couple of them just kind of stayed in contact to troubleshoot if we needed some additional, particularly around the software. And we did like some security features on our Wi-Fi and things. Mm-hmm. So they came back a couple of times, and then the pandemic hit, and I think that kind of scattered
things.
On some of the other projects, they've lasted a good while, so I don't even know we're at the point yet where we've been out of contact with them for that long, because I feel like they just finished. If I think about like our Mission Possible project, some of those folks are still in contact with us, which is great.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to end our discussion because we're running out of time. But I want to say to you what I say to all of our nonprofit partners. Remember, those volunteers can become your volunteers, your board members, your donors. Yeah, there are Aparo volunteers, but they are yours. You know, when they come in contact with you, they become yours. And to me, that's one of the wonderful, rich ecosystems that comes out of this kind of work together. So if they're still engaged with you, there might be some board member potential there, or certainly some donor potential. Don't let it slip. And we don't care. Go for it.
Okay.
Aaron, thank you so much for this conversation. I've loved learning about how you've steered this ship to where it is, to such incredible impact. And we wish you so much more success on the important work you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate it and look forward to our continued partnership as well.
Yeah.